from NPR News in Washington, D.C. This is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, an Arkansas meteorologist on this weekend's snow. Then, how has President Trump deployed the U.S. military in his second term? Cardinal Blaise Cupich of Chicago on the president's foreign policy and immigration enforcement. Gus Van Sant on his new movie, Dead Man's Wire. And Greg Davies and Alex Horn of Taskmaster, where British comedians compete to do pretty useless things.
I like it when it all goes wrong, and I like it when it's inherently silly.
There's normally someone who's desperate to win and someone who is desperately useless.
Ah, desperation comes in all forms. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, January 24, 2026.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets in downtown Minneapolis Friday in sub-zero temperatures in protest of the continued surge of federal immigration agents in the state. The Minnesota Reformer reports 100 members of the clergy were arrested at a separate protest action that morning at a Minneapolis St. Paul Airport terminal. The actions, along with the continued demonstrations at the Whipple Federal Building, converged on what is being dubbed the Ice Out of Minnesota Day of Truth and Freedom, when hundreds of businesses closed as organizers urged Minnesotans not to attend school or work or go shopping Friday. The economic blackout, according to a demonstration website, was, quote, to suspend the normal order of business to demand immediate cessation of ICE actions in Minnesota, accountability for federal agents who have caused loss of life and abuse to Minnesota residents, and call for Congress to immediately intervene. Attorney General Keith Ellison filed a lawsuit earlier this month against the Department of Homeland Security, alleging that Operation Metro Surge is unconstitutional and unlawful. A hearing to consider a temporary restraining order against DHS Secretary Kristi Noem and other leaders in the department is slated for Monday. Two northwestern Minnesota sheriffs announced they are not seeking re-election this November. Becker County Sheriff Todd Glander announced last Friday he would be retiring at the end of December after wearing the office badge for nearly 40 years. Glander has served the last 11 years as sheriff and was initially hired in 1988 as a jailer. Clearwater County Sheriff Darren Halverson announced he would not seek a fourth term on Tuesday. Halverson is hanging it up after more than 30 years of service as a peace officer, working for the Clearbrook and Bagley Police Departments before he was elected sheriff. A Grand Rapids chef is among those nominated for a James Beard Award this week. While most nominees are chefs and restaurants in major metropolitan areas across the country, Kyle Lusher, co-owner of the new restaurant The Pines, is a semifinalist for the Emerging Chef Award. The James Beard Awards, according to a release, recognize restaurant and bar professionals who, quote, collectively embody the breadth of American culinary excellence. Lusher, in a KAXE morning show interview, describes The Pines as a farm-to-table restaurant that takes northern Minnesotan staples like walleye and wild rice and turns them into something new.
A sort of gentle handshake of some familiar foods and flavors, and then also pairing that with maybe different things or new things or, a different technique or a twist on a flavor profile. It's kind of holistic, but I think it's viewed through the lens of, you know, what we eat up here and what we can grow up here.
James Beard Award finalists will be announced in late March with an award ceremony to celebrate winners planned June 15th in Chicago. The DNR is nearing the end of the first phase of its efforts to update Minnesota's public waters inventory. The inventory was created in the 1980s and is an important reference for enforcing state water protection laws and guiding development and conservation decisions. The agency began an 8-year update project last year with the goal of updating 12 counties each year. Aiken is one of the first four counties. The DNR is proposing adding 16 waterways and removing one lake from the public waters list. Public comment on the changes is open until February 27th. The DNR will host a public meeting 6 p.m. Wednesday at the Aiken Public Library. The state's Department of Transportation recently announced more than $76 million in grants to support projects that improve freight options, travel time, and economic development. Two projects in northern Minnesota will receive some of this funding. The city of Two Harbors will receive nearly $5 million to reconstruct Highway 61. The project also includes roundabouts and other intersection enhancements to extend the life of the corridor. Nearly $2 million of this funding will go toward intermodal and railroad improvements at the Cloquet Terminal. This project will better accommodate stacking and cargo at the Sappy Paper Cloquet Mill. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
From NPR News, I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. is facing one of its biggest winter storms in decades. The storm is bringing snow, ice, and freezing temperatures to more than a dozen states as it moves from the Rockies across the plains today and then into the Northeast tomorrow. Some 200 million Americans are under weather alerts. That's more than half the population, and tens of thousands of people have already lost power. Barry Brandt is chief meteorologist with ABC 7 in Little Rock, Arkansas, and joins us now. Mr. Brandt, thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, good day to you. What a storm we have coming our way.
Well, tell us about it. What are you seeing so far today? Because you're in the direct path, as I understand it.
Yes, we are in the direct path. Last night, we had a starting of sleet and snow, and it's going to kind of be a mixed bag of precipitation types. And we're going to have all of them here, from freezing rain, that ice in southern Arkansas, to heavy snow in north Arkansas. And then we're kind of in the middle of the state, in Little Rock, in that combination zone. Last night, it snowed a lot. So it is already piling up. It will continue all day today. We're not going to make it out of the teens. This is a very impactful snow. And it doesn't just stop here. It's all, as you said, from southern Rockies to the northeast.
How are people in Little Rock doing?
You know, so far, great. It didn't start until later last night, so we were able to have another evening of preparation. There were a lot of folks out. But I think if people try to get out today, during the day, it's only going to get worse. So there'll be accidents. Hopefully everybody's staying at home. And I think that's good advice, no matter where you are in the United States affected by this storm.
And what are you most concerned about?
I think in our state, not just the ice in southern Arkansas, but the heavy, heavy snow. We could have 10 or 15 inches of snow north, and that runs right along that I-40 corridor all the way toward Nashville and then eventually up into the big cities of the Northeast. Ice, though, is the worst, and that's freezing rain. That's liquid rain that falls, and at the surface, it freezes. You've got power lines, you've got trees, and you've got power outages that are just going to be really, really awful. Already starting, but it's going to get a whole lot worse.
That's because the ice freezes on the power lines and that creates more weight and the power lines come down, right?
Yeah, they say in just a short stretch of power lines, you can have a quarter inch of ice and it puts 500 pounds of pressure just between power poles. So it's going to bring power lines down. And that's what everybody is so concerned about, because it's so cold. And if you can't heat your house, then it becomes a real issue. Sleet is another deal. That's frozen ice pellets. It doesn't accumulate on tree limbs or power lines.
Storm is making its way east. What are you eyeing today and into tomorrow?
Well, I have friends in the eastern United States and family members. I just looked over into Nashville. They're going to have a real mixed bag, sort of like central Arkansas. They're going to have sleet and heavy snow, but they also have a freezing rain, that ice component to it, and that will go all the way to Washington, D.C. I think the Atlanta metro, they're in an ice storm warning, and that's really going to pick up as we head into this evening and then into the Carolinas, the southern Appalachians. That's going to be an ice zone. You go north, you go from Oklahoma City to Missouri, up through the Ohio Valley, and then eventually all the way to New England, to Maine. This is from New Mexico to Maine. It's just a broad swath of just terrible winter weather. I don't think I've seen anything like this for quite some time.
Well, that's saying something. Barry Brandt, chief meteorologist with ABC 7 in Little Rock, Arkansas. Have a good weekend. Thanks for making time to speak with us.
Scott, stay safe. Thanks.
At Davos this week, President Trump took any possible military action against Greenland off the table. He said there is a framework of a deal with respect to both Greenland and the entire Arctic region, but details were sparse. And on the way home, the president told reporters he had just sent a, quote, armada of U.S. naval forces headed towards Iran, in case he had to take action. And there are, of course, also active duty military on standby for possible deployment to Minneapolis. In Donald Trump's second term, the military, both at home and abroad, is at the center of many of his most controversial actions. We're joined now by NPR's Tom Bowman and Quill Lawrence. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Yes, thank you.
Tom, let's begin domestically. How have we seen the military deployed here at home?
Well, Scott, if you left the studio and walked to the window and looked down North Capitol Street here in Washington, you would likely see National Guard troops walking up and down the street. There are more than 2,000 National Guard troops here in D.C. right now, and they've been extended all through 2026. And also, Guard troops have gone to Memphis, New Orleans. Trump tried to send out-of-state Guard troops to Oregon and Illinois. Federal judges said that's not a good idea. There's no need for that. Now we have active duty forces, Scott, on standby from Colorado, from Alaska, and from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, more than 2,000 of them in total, on pre-deployment orders to go to Minneapolis if need be.
And let's turn to you both, because given the president's comments, military action against Iran remains possible. U.S. is still boarding oil tankers off of Venezuela, where, of course, just 3 weeks ago, U.S. forces seized President Maduro. What do you see as being different in terms of the U.S. military being deployed in the second term from the Trump first term? Tom?
Well, you're right, Scott. Venezuela, they seized President Maduro. That was a Delta Force. It was a raid. It was a targeted mission to grab Maduro, get him out, and send him to New York for prosecution. There were no, outside of that, boots on the ground. You're not looking at a large-scale military operation like we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't think Trump wants to have that kind of open-ended military mission.
Quill?
Yeah, it can seem like a contradiction because at the same time as the Pentagon is pushing out this message of, let's say, mess around and find out and lethality, Trump and many of the people in his administration have talked about kind of an America first isolationism. But what's consistent is what Tom's saying is there's this aversion to any boots on the ground or any responsibility, sense of owning it just because you broke it, to turn around the old pottery barn rule.
And certainly no nation building like we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And yeah, to talk about Iraq, I mean, the U.S. this week just left its last base in central Iraq. And in Syria, it's announced pretty bluntly that it's abandoning any support for the Kurdish forces that did most of the fighting against ISIS there. But already you see this result is that, you know, these Kurdish forces on the ground in northeast Syria, they were guarding thousands of ISIS prisoners. And in the fighting with the Syrian government, the Kurds have now pulled back from, hundreds of those ISIS fighters escaped. So no boots on the ground, but also, you know, fewer allies on the ground, which means there can be consequences for that.
Let me ask you both about the question of legality. I'm thinking less about Maduro or boarding the tankers and the boat strikes near Venezuela. Does this put the U.S. into unknown territory?
No, there are definitely questions about that. Now, the Justice Department has said these boat strikes are legal And their argument is that these boats are carrying drugs to the United States that are killing tens of thousands of Americans. Therefore, we can attack these boats because they're killing Americans. There are many people in Congress and defense analysts who question that. And we do know that the former head of Southern Command, Admiral Halsey, he actually resigned over this issue. He had, I'm told by Capitol Hill sources, reservations about these boat strikes, and he decided to resign rather than continue.
Quill? I spoke with Sarah Yeager about this. She used to work at the Department of Defense advising the Joint Chiefs on humanitarian law. She's now at Human Rights Watch. She said the Pentagon has specifically fired the staff that used to advise the targeters and the operators.
So there was a large staff that was dealing with civilian harm mitigation, meaning making sure that civilians were not harmed in U.S. operations. That has been gutted. The guardrails that kept rules of engagement from being unlawful, those have been dismantled.
And this is playing out with military leadership, too. In a recent Senate confirmation hearing for two generals to replace the heads of Southern Command, who Tom just mentioned, and the heads of Cyber Command. I mean, one is replacing an admiral that quite possibly left because he had objections to what he thought were illegal orders killing the people in these fast boats. The other was replacing a general that got the sack because he ran afoul of a right-wing conspiracy theorist, Laura Loomer. So you have a Republican senator, chairman of this committee, assuring them that they should speak their minds and tell the senators how they really feel. But there is uncertainty as to sort of what is grounds for dismissal and what they can say and still keep their careers.
And along those lines, Scott, I just had breakfast with a retired four-star officer who said, listen, his friends who are still on active duty are afraid to say anything, afraid to stand up to Secretary Hegseth or go afoul of President Trump. They're afraid of getting fired because, as you know, many admirals and generals have been fired over the past year by this administration. And the consequence of that, Scott, is we used to get background briefings from military officials, senior military officials, about, let's say, Venezuela, what's going on there, what's the possibilities for Iran. Those have all dried up. Last year, there were only two Pentagon briefings by Secretary Hegseth. So as a result of all that, the American people aren't getting a sense of what the military is doing in their name.
And here's Tom Bowman and Quill Lawrence. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Jennifer Barr, and on a recent Monday morning show, we talked with longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media and what KAXE means to him.
So that puts it at more than 20 years, 22-some years of appearing on KAXE, and I've been privileged to, you know, do the morning show, like segments like this, but also on the Great Northern Radio Show and Dig Deep. And when Heidi Holton was producing Between You and Me, I was a frequent contributor there for years and years. You may not think of KAXE as big time media, but I feel like that experience trained me. I mean, the quality that the station puts out of our programming is just amazing. And my experience, it was the fastest and easiest decision to spend money that we've had in our almost 25 years of marriage. She said, let's do it.
Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support. Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 8:19. You can get rid of that unwanted car, truck, or boat. KAXE's Cars program makes it quick and easy, and you can get it towed away for free. The proceeds from your unwanted vehicle become fuel for your favorite community radio station, which we hope is KAXE, KBXE. You can call Heather to get started, 218-326-1234, or visit KAXE.org/cars. Lead for Inclusion invites community members age 14 and up to a book club discussion of When Stars Are Scattered. That is happening Wednesday, March 4th, but if you would like to get started on the book, you can email info@leadforinclusion.org to get your free copy. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. We continue with Weekend Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump backed off this week on his threat to impose new tariffs on European goods in exchange for what he called a framework of a future deal involving Greenland. Polls show most Americans don't want the U.S. to take control of Greenland. They do want the president to focus more on the economy, especially the high cost of living. A survey from the University of Michigan this week shows Americans feel worse about the economy now than they did a year ago, but that bad feeling has not stopped people from spending money. And NPR's Scott Horsley joins us. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
And you have some sales receipts there. What do they show?
Yeah, they show that even during the government shutdown this past fall, when people's mood about the economy hit bottom, they didn't dial back their spending. On the contrary, spending rose pretty sharply during the fall. Economist Tim Quinlan, who's with Wells Fargo, says the numbers suggest that despite people's deep funk about the economy, they continued to shell out not only for necessities like food and rent. We also saw more spending on things like recreation.
Growing faster than many people would have thought when there was a lot of hand-wringing about the impact of tariffs and, you know, labor market that's losing momentum. But one way or another, the consumer just keeps finding a way to keep spending.
Now, for some families, finding a way might mean dipping into savings or reaching for a credit card, because in both October and November, spending increased faster than people's incomes did.
And how long can, if I might put it this way, we keep that up before we run out of money?
Well, there are already signs some families have hit the wall. Procter & Gamble said this week that some anxious shoppers are beginning to skimp on things like laundry detergent and even toilet paper. Now, presumably that just means switching from P&G Charmin to a cheaper brand. But, you know, there are lots of examples of kind of two-speed spending behavior where upper-income families are able to splurge while lower-income families are just scraping by. The Darden restaurant chain, for example, has a wide variety of offerings, from the never-ending pasta bowl at Olive Garden, which is just under $14, to a $90 Wagyu filet at the Capitol Grill. And CEO Rick Cardina says Darden's doing fine thanks to middle- and upper-income customers who are offsetting any cutbacks by those at the bottom.
The consumer's still resilient. They're being cautious, with the largest growth coming from our higher-income households. But there was a little pullback in those earning less than $50,000 in casual brands.
Now, wealthier families might feel like they can afford to spend more because, you know, the stocks in their retirement account are doing okay and their home values are climbing, whereas people living paycheck to paycheck may feel like they have to tighten their belts.
Scott, is there any help on the horizon for lower-income families?
There could be some. They may get a bigger tax refund this year and perhaps see a little boost in their take-home pay, thanks to the GOP tax cut passed last summer, although we know most of the benefits of the tax cut are going to go to higher-income families. We talk all the time about how consumer spending is the biggest engine of the U.S. economy. Tim Quinlan notes that engine is increasingly driven by a relatively small slice of well-off shoppers.
The unpleasant truth of it is the top 10% of households give you almost half of all of the overall spending. So if those households are doing well, that kind of papers over the struggles that people have at different levels of income.
Car makers, for example, have been reporting solid sales, even though it's getting harder for middle and lower income families to afford a new car. You can have a macroeconomy that looks pretty good on the surface, even if a lot of families are struggling to pay their bills.
I'm Bear Scott Horsley. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now it's time for sports. And NFL Conference Championships. The coaching carousel turns into a twister, and no surprises at the Australian Open, but for how long? Sports writer Howard Bryan joins us. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm just awaiting the snowpocalypse, Scott. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Same, same, my friend. Look, Denver Broncos host the New England Patriots, but they'll have to do it without their young starting quarterback, Bo Nix, fractured his right ankle against the Bills. Does they have a shot with their backup quarterback, Jarrett Stidham, against New England?
Yes, the former Patriot, Jarrett Stidham. There's always a chance up there. It's the real Patriots fans know that Denver is the house of horrors for that franchise. Even Bill Belichick and Tom Brady never won a playoff game up there. Doesn't make a difference if the quarterback is Jake Plummer or Peyton Manning or John Elway. The Patriots, yeah. It's always going to be a struggle up there, but it's a big blow. This is a one versus two seed. The Patriots clearly have the advantage because they've got their full team. But once again, you go up there and you play in that altitude and anything can happen. Yeah.
And later tomorrow, the Seahawks host the LA Rams, ticket to the Super Bowl on the line. Seahawks have the best scoring defense in the league. The Rams have the best scoring offense. They've played each other twice, split the series. What do you foresee? A tie in two overtime periods?
A tie in two overtimes. Well, just like with the Patriots and the Broncos, this has been a great, great postseason in terms of rivalry. I mean, I know the Patriots and the Broncos didn't play each other this year, but once again, when you get these teams together who have these historic battles or these historical battles, you really just never know what's going to happen. Seahawks and the Rams, at one point during the season, Scott, I was convinced that the Rams were the best team in the NFL. Then they slipped a little bit. And then, the Seahawks go up and they go, 14-3. And so these may very well be, I know the Eagles were the defending champions, but these are probably the two best teams in the NFL right now. And also, they split the season series. But I think the Rams have a little bit of the edge, even though they're on the road. Let's not forget the last time the Rams and the Seahawks played up in Seattle. The Seahawks had to come back. They were down 30-14 in that game. The Rams were killing them, and then it was a great comeback. They come back. They win 38-37 in overtime. So when you've got a division game, it's the third time these guys have played each other. It's going to be a really good battle.
And all the coaching carousel. Mike Tomlin departs the Steelers after 19 seasons. John Harbaugh, the Ravens, fired after 18 years there. Buffalo Bills got rid of Sean McDermott after 9 years. He only took the Bills to the playoffs 8 times. When has the NFL turned into the what have you done for me lately organization?
Yeah, there has been talk for decades about which sport has the most coaching necessity. And it's always been football. Football is the one where the coach really does make the difference for lots of reasons. One, incredibly complicated game. Two, you are running a massive operation. Basketball, you've got, it's a 12-player roster. Baseball, it's a 25-man roster. Football, it's like 70 players. And very, very specialized, the whole thing. I mean, so you really have to have your hand on the leadership button. You have to really know what you're doing, and people have to respond to you in numerous different elements. And that really protected the coaches. And you could see the difference. Look at a guy like Sean McDermott. Not, as you just said, not only does he take them to the playoffs every year, they'd won 10 games the last 7 straight seasons. But now I think with a lot of the analytics happening right now, I think that with the money going as high as it's going, the coaches are the most vulnerable. Football coaches are the most vulnerable they've ever been in this sport. The owners aren't going to fire themselves, and they're not going to get rid of all their players. So suddenly the firing of the coach has actually sort of become part of the DNA. They even have a name for it now. What do they call it? Black Monday. In other words, it's part of the show, getting rid of the coach.
Mm. Howard Bryant, thanks so much. Talk to you soon, my friend.
My pleasure, Scott.
This week, 3 prominent cardinals of the U.S. Catholic Church criticized the foreign policies of the Trump administration, including the seizure of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, cuts to U.S. humanitarian aid programs, and threats to seize Greenland. Our country's moral role in confronting evil around the world, sustaining the right to life and human dignity, and supporting religious liberty are all under examination. Cardinals Joseph Tobin of Newark, Robert McElroy of Washington, D.C., and Blaise Supich of Chicago said in a statement. Cardinal Supich joins us now. Eminence, thank you for being with us.
Good to be with you again, Scott.
What prompted you to speak out? Isn't U.S. foreign policy the business of a democratically elected government and not the church?
Well, when we were in Rome, the three of us with the other cardinals, we heard many expressions of alarm by cardinals around the world about what's happening. And then the day after we finished, Pope Leo addressed the diplomatic corps accredited to the Vatican, and he raised a number of issues with regard to how we're seeing the collapse of a consensus since the Second World War that spoke to issues such as how countries relate to deal with conflict, how we also respect each other's borders and sovereignty of nations, and also to have dialogue. And so those are things that should not be forgotten that the Pope wanted to raise up in his address to the diplomatic corps. And we wanted to make sure that message was extended as we spoke to people in our country.
What about the argument, for example, that 8 million Venezuelans have voted with their feet and left their own country? It's a quarter of the population. Hasn't removing Nicolas Maduro to stand trial for drug trafficking in the U.S. opened the door to change?
Yes, I think that the end result of having this man brought to justice is important to recognize. But as the saying goes, the end doesn't always justify the means. But the issue here is when a country that is powerful can dominate other countries simply because of their power and their ability to do so. That has not been the way the world order has worked since the Second World War. At least it those are the principles that were in place. And so there has to be a worldwide consensus of how we deal with difficulties and conflicts in the world. And that's what something we wanted to draw attention to.
Cardinal, you and a number of other leaders of the church have also been outspoken about the administration's current policies on removing migrants. What are your concerns?
So we were very clear that every country has a right and responsibility to protect its borders and safeguard its people. But the real issue here for us was the indiscriminate mass deportation of people and the lack of a recognition that we're in this situation today because elected leaders have not done their job in having significant immigration reform. And so that is why the full conference of bishops made very clear that we oppose the indiscriminate mass deportation of people simply because it seems to be very unfair in its application. And also doesn't put the responsibility back on legislatures to do their job and have significant immigration reform.
Let me ask, could a Gesundheit. I just said God bless you to a cardinal. We should reverse roles, sorry.
That's right.
Could a migrant or migrant family seek sanctuary at a church in your archdiocese? Would you try to prevent ICE agents from entering?
Well, we have decided that we're not going to use that means simply because we believe that in the long run it sets up a conflict that really is not going to help the situation. Pardon me.
No, that's all right. Thank you. Let me ask you another question, if I can, if you're still with us, Cardinal Supich.
Go ahead.
National Right to Life March in Washington, D.C. was yesterday. Vice President Vance, Speaker Johnson were there. There may be Americans wondering how you in the church can be in favor of migrant rights and against abortion rights. How do you see that?
I don't think that it's a zero-sum game. I think our position is we're for the protection of human dignity across the board, whether it's the person on death row, immigrants, the child in the womb, or the elderly, and with regard to increasing legislation that allows assisted suicide. So our position would be that across the board, the metric has to be, how does this protect human dignity and human life?
And a number of clergy members have been arrested in Minneapolis protesting against ICE deportations. Do you believe that there's a role of clergy in protests and offering themselves for arrest?
I think there's a role for citizens to take up action whenever they disagree with any public policy. And it's up to religious leaders to make sure that the moral framework in decision-making is in place. Yesterday, the Holy Father sent a message to a group of people in meeting in Luxembourg on European security. And he said the underlying problem we have right today is a spread of relativism, a reduction of truth to one's opinion. So there have to be standards and held truths that inform our norms and values. And that is what our argument is.
Cardinal Subic of Chicago, thank you. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Before there was American Idol, The Voice, or Dancing with the Stars, there was...
Stars!
NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the hit 1980s and 90s TV talent show is getting a Netflix reboot with a twist for the TikTok generation.
The original Star Search wasn't the first TV talent contest, but it helped propel more than its fair share of budding stars into the stratosphere. Britney Spears, Dave Chappelle.
You guys notice Batman never fights crime in neighborhoods that need it.
And Beyoncé. All got a big push from Star Search, though none of them went on to win it.
We're trying to recreate that energy where everyone on this show can be a star and deserves to be.
Jesse Collins is the executive producer of Netflix's new Star Search reboot. The 9-episode series, which premiered this week, has many of the same ingredients as the original. A cast of adorable young talent like 10-year-old country singer Blair Kudelka. An avuncular host in actor Anthony Anderson.
But it's past your bedtime right now, so go home.
And a panel of celebrity judges, in this case, actress Sarah Michelle Gellar, rapper Jelly Roll, and model Chrissy Teigen.
Chrissy?
3 stars.
But there are differences. Perhaps most significantly, Collins says,
the audience is truly the fourth judge.
Viewers around the world get a say in who wins by voting on performances with their TV remote or phone in real time. And they get to find out the results almost immediately.
Our 3 judges gave you a total score of 3.6 stars. But that's not all that matters. Let's see what the 4th judge, the viewers around the world, gave you.
Today's stars are now often born on YouTube and TikTok rather than mainstream TV. Netflix is betting on a combination of nostalgia for the original show and the instant gratification brought about by the real-time interactivity of the new one to make Star Search stand out. In an email statement to NPR, the streamer's vice president of unscripted series, Jeff Gaspin, says, quote, this level of immediacy turns a passive viewing experience into a live interactive event. Not everyone thinks it will work.
I think people look to television for, you know, a more passive experience, and they look to other screens for a more active experience.
James Poniewozik is the New York Times' chief TV critic. He says the return of Star Search reveals bifurcated ambitions for Netflix. On the one hand, Poniewozik says the streamer is trying to make itself the go-to for all sorts of content, just like old-fashioned network TV.
We got a little something for everybody. We got reality, and we've got dramas, and we got comedies, and we got, you know, now sports, boxing, whatever.
On the other hand, the critic says, streamers like Netflix have purposefully brought about a very different viewing landscape, one where people can watch most anything at any time.
Kind of breaks up the audience in that way from the kind of global village that made a show like Star Search possible.
Star Search host Anthony Anderson acknowledges it's a challenge watching TV right now because of the abundance of choices, but he's leaning into his show's pedigree.
When you say Star Search, people know exactly what that was and what they're going to get with that show.
Anderson says he's confident viewers will continue to tune in for that. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:39. You're listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets 6 o'clock this Monday, January 26, at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are the fourth Monday of the month, and find the Board's meeting schedule at kaxe.org. Support comes from Paper Storm, providing on-site paper shredding services to commercial and residential customers throughout central and northern Minnesota, accepting old paperwork during tax season with secure shredding services. More information at paperstorm.net. We also receive support from Bemidji Brewing at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. Their new year starts with beer infusions and events such as Tropical Escape Week featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at bemidjibeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch.
I'm Winsor Johnston with these headlines. A massive winter storm is set to hit large parts of the U.S. this weekend. The National Weather Service says snow, ice, and dangerous cold could stretch from the Rockies to the East Coast, putting some 200 million people at risk. Thousands of demonstrators marched through downtown Minneapolis on Friday to protest federal immigration enforcement. Tensions have been high in the city amid the presence of ICE agents. The Trump administration is ordering public housing authorities nationwide to immediately verify tenant citizenship status or risk losing federal funding. The move follows a federal audit that found nearly 200,000 households receiving rental assistance may require additional eligibility review. I'm Winsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Gus Van Sant's new film takes us back to a true story from the 1970s that echoes into today. February 8, 1977, an Indianapolis man named Tony Kouritzis takes Dick Hall hostage. Now, Hall is a broker at the mortgage company that holds Dick Kouritzis' loan for a parcel of land. Kouritzis ties a wire from the trigger of his sawed-off shotgun to Dick Hall's neck.
Tony, what is this?
This here, Dick, is a dead man's wire. If you faint, stumble, or try to run, there it is. There it is. Look, this will blow your head off.
Now listen, Tony. No one's seen us. Okay, you've made your point.
I'm just getting started.
The crime would become a 63-hour standoff that captured local and national attention and has been the subject of a documentary and a podcast. Dead Man's Wire stars Bill Skarsgård, Dacre Montgomery, Cary Elwes, Coleman Domingo, and Al Pacino. It is the latest film from the esteemed director Gus Van Sant, who joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
What drew you into telling the story today?
A friend of mine was intent on making it. He had found the original writer of the film had seen a documentary about the incident and was compelled to do it because of its intensity.
And why is Tony Kouritzis so upset about his mortgage?
He's very close to the mortgage vendors, and the head of the company, M.L. Hall, was treating him very well, and I think he was missing some payments that M.L. Hall wasn't happy with, and that made Tony feel like M.L. Hall had maybe ulterior motives to maybe develop the project himself.
M.L. Hall, who was Dick Hall's father and chairman of the mortgage company, vacationing in Florida at the time of the kidnapping, by the way, played by Al Pacino. What keeps him from just offering an apology and promising a loan?
That was one of the main questions of the story. And in our story, he's saying that it's because the police are listening and they're recording it. and he can't admit any wrongdoing because it was going to end up in court.
Okay, Dad. So Tony's here with me, and if you wanted to take a moment to apologize, I think it would go a long way, you know, and possibly expedite this release process. So if you wanted to do that, then it might be a great idea.
Apologize for what exactly, Rich?
Well, you know, possibly setting up a deal that wasn't in his interest.
Apologize for how interest works.
So he wouldn't say that he was sorry.
In your telling, Tony gets a popular radio DJ named Fred Temple, played by Coleman Domingo, directly involved in the drama.
Hello. Hello? Hello? Hi.
Hello, Mr. Caritzis. This is Fred Temple.
Oh, hi, Fred. It's an honor, Fred. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Yeah. Hey, you wanted to speak with me.
We'll just note that in the real case, Fred Hickman, who was the news director of a local station, was actually the character. But what does Tony Caritzis see or hear or find in this local DJ?
He is a fan of Fred Temple, but I don't think he was expecting sort of the elation that he felt by hearing himself on the radio.
This morning has been crazy, man. They aired my interview with Fred. Fred's on my side, and the people are listening.
Tony, hearing his own voice and his own philosophies broadcast on the radio, sort of made him weak-kneed, and and also depending more and more on Fred Temple.
It does introduce the fact that the media becomes another character. What do you think happened, and what should we take from that today?
It's an early example of a lot of media coverage from local stations that descended on the apartment building where Tony was holding his hostage, to the point where Tony was eventually asking for all media to record him making a statement at the end of the 3 days. And he requested ABC, CBS, and NBC to broadcast his statement live in an afternoon, a particular afternoon.
I mean, you say request, but it's request or else, right? That was the implication.
Yeah, request, one of his requests, or there might be trouble.
Of course, this actually happened in 1977, so I don't give away any plot twist to note that Tony Caritzis was found not guilty by reason of insanity. I got to tell you, I found myself seeing this whole story close up in your film, angry about that. Tony Caritzis carried out a deliberate, planned, and prolonged act of violence.
Yeah, that was an odd verdict. And I think that type of insanity verdict is a lot harder to come by. It's not the same as it was in the 70s.
They changed the law, apparently. I learned by reading up about your film.
Yeah, they've changed it, yeah.
Were there times making this film that you said to yourself, how could this have happened?
I think the thing that makes it kind of the most astounding was that nobody had, like, rescued Richard Hall, that they were walking all through town, I guess because of the rig, but they sort of left them alone, which I think was astounding.
Gus Van Sant, his new film, Dead Man's Wire, is in theaters now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Taskmaster is a well-known British game series.
A group of comics battling out to see who is the least worst at doing a thing. No one will learn anything from the next hour, so crack open a can and give in to the pointlessness.
Five contestants, usually comedians, are told to perform a series of tasks like do the riskiest thing involving an egg without breaking an egg, place something somewhere surprising, or eat as much watermelon as possible in 1 minute.
Cut a single string to cause the greatest effect.
You have 20 minutes.
Your time starts now.
Greatest effect is pretty broad.
The hosts of Taskmaster are Greg Davies and Alex Horn. They've been on tour here in the U.S. and joined us now in our studios. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you. Scott. Thanks for having us.
What's the point of all those inane tasks?
Yeah, they did sound a name. When you were listing them, it sounded, I think it's quite a highbrow show.
The introduction did suggest that we're not cerebral.
Or uselessly cerebral, yeah, I think would correct. Be part of it too. Yeah.
There is very little point, except to let comedians play. I think that's the point of the show. We're trying to let comedians be funny and be themselves. It seems to work.
Is it entertaining because there are notably witty people who will do anything for a laugh? What is it?
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, we choose comedians to be on it. Yeah. So they're naturally inclined to try and be funny.
We do cast the show very carefully, though, and make sure we have five different personalities. And there's normally someone who's desperate to win and someone who is desperately useless. So I think we just need that balance.
I think the joy of the show is we take them out of their comfort zone. Yeah. I think comedians are very good at sort of using their shtick. But on our show, it has its own rules.
We also have well-known people, so you think you know them.
Up next, Jason Mantzoukas. He's exiting the Taskmaster house with undue confidence.
For example, we've had this country's Jason Mantzoukas, and in the coming series, Kumail Nanjiani. But you'll see a different side to them because there's no script, so they can't come in knowing what they're going to do.
I'm not trying to get points now. I'm just on my secondary mission, which is always ongoing. Destroy, dismantle, engulf in flames.
Alex, 21st season
of
Taskmaster will air this spring.
That's right.
You're the creator. Take us back to that blinding moment where you thought...
Well, I will tell you back, because it was when my wife had our first child in 2009. So it suddenly dawned on me that we're going to have to somehow pay for this thing to stay alive. So it's quite a desperate year where I came up with lots of ideas. So there's something called the Edinburgh Fringe where comedians go and play in Scotland every year. So I just came up with this idea of setting, it used to be 20 comedians, one challenge a month. The first one was put some money in my bank account, the most money wins. So that paid for the whole thing. And and it instantly was obvious that comedians were competitive. So I did one show in Edinburgh and it was meant to be just a one-off, but it kind of grew from there. And then we got Greg in pretty quickly, because I didn't have the right personality to host it. That's when the real task
came. He doesn't have enough bombast.
I've hardly got any bombast.
And I have too much.
Well, you're going to have to judge this, Greg.
Jenny's definitely helped me out.
Yes. Okay.
1 point for Jenny and Claire.
I got to tell you, Greg, I do not get your point system.
Nor do I.
It seems totally random, capricious.
But it does, doesn't it?
Book, lazy, 3 points.
Right. I'm going to give Joe a pity point and take her up to 2 points.
I love the air horn. It reminds me of the 80s. And that is my justification.
Rosie would be right at the top if I were allowed to accept bribes, but I can't.
Okay, two for you.
And Nish is in last place. I'm not going to justify it because he's already annoying me.
I would argue... Isn't that life? Do our leaders always make the right call, or are they fallible?
History will judge. Time will tell, as we say.
And right? I'll be long gone, so be it.
Do you have, may I ask, that putting you on the spot, Alex, do you have help in putting together the tasks?
Oh, I thought you meant medical help.
please, Alex, yes.
There is a very small team who make the show and have made the show from the beginning, and I'm very open to suggestions and... In general, it's just me. And I think it's partly because when I was growing up in my family, we did play a lot of games at Christmas and it was structured fun and that's what we did. So it's always been in the back of my brain that, games are what you're supposed to do.
Without making it programmatic, do you have any ideas what makes a good task?
It's quite instinctive, but I was a comedian. Greg and I met on the comedy circuit and I used to write jokes and now I write tasks instead of jokes. So you just feel it. An idea will pop into your head and you go, yep, that works. So it's just something which has a variety of solutions, something that's inherently slightly funny but not too funny.
And you have had to adapt to some extent, haven't you? Because we've done so many seasons now that contestants are wise to some of his tricks.
They sniff
out. So he does have to, that'd be fair to say,
slightly adapt. Yeah, I have to put more caveats saying, yes, but you can't do that. You can't move the chair or whatever it is.
They look for shortcuts.
Yeah. Which is to be encouraged. We like people who work around the rules. We don't mind cheating as long as they try to get away with it.
Yeah.
We do have one for you at some point, Scott.
I'm ready to receive your suggestion.
You're going to do it, Scott. And then I think two of your colleagues are going to come and do it as well. And we're going to see who's best at it. But you can watch the others do it, but they can't watch you do it. Otherwise, they will know. Because in the show, you come and do it in isolation.
Right, yes. Okay.
So I'm going to hand over an official envelope. This is from the show.
Oh, yes.
With the official wax seal, which we do...
Taskmaster seal on it.
Yeah, we do that properly with real wax every day.
This is really nice.
This is the one that all contestants get as their first task in the show. This is their warm-up task. So everyone who's done the show has done this task.
All right. Say one word every 2 seconds.
Any word? Like, it doesn't need to make a...
No, I'm going to give you the first word.
Okay.
Each word must start with the last letter of the previous word, and your words must be... Oh, God forbid. And your words must be different. You must say each word between the strokes of the metronome.
Oh, it's you're a metronome.
I'll just demonstrate
okay,
now.
Got it. Okay.
It'll sound like this. Word.
Yeah.
Word.
Got it.
So okay. It's got to be in that gap.
So then it would be like, previous word... Stupid.
Just one
dog.
Word at a time, Hadil.
Okay,
just,
great, got yeah. it.
Well, what are you calling me?
Yummy. Yeah.
So if you started with Miles, the next one would begin
yes.
with S.
Yep.
But Greg's going to give you your first word.
Oh, okay.
And then we start.
Okay.
The word is newt.
Newt, here we go.
Tall. Latte. Enough.
So Greg right, will go. Give you your first word and then we're off. And you've got to try to beat Scott.
Oh, okay.
Snake.
Echo. Orange. Elephant.
Okay, Greg, you ready with Miles' first word?
I'm so ready. Cheese.
Even. Night.
Totally.
Tiger.
I don't know why I keep using why. I don't know. Mm. Yacht.
See, that felt like a long...
Tomato.
Gap. No, we're still going.
Rewind. Diddle. Everything.
Happy.
Go.
Yellow.
One.
Wasp. Portrait. Tea.
Night.
Oh, darn.
For flips NPR sake.
Do you want me to keep going? Orange.
I think you failed.
Well, orange as well again.
I think you failed.
Failed
Did you
quite.
Say yak?
No, I said yacht.
Diddle? Is diddle a word? It feels.
You think it's a word. Hey, diddle, diddle. And you said orange a couple of times.
Yes. Yeah,
quite keen on saying orange.
I don't feel good.
Oh. I mean, I think the winner probably was Scott.
It's weird how it means nothing and I'll be thinking about it for weeks.
But I don't think this cancels out all the great work you've done as a journalist.
Thank
no.
You.
Yeah, no, it sure does.
We still respect okay. you.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Miles. Thank
you,
Miles.
I'm sorry to
Thanks,
you
Miles.
Both.
Adil Olshalchi and Miles Parks.
Nice to meet you, Adil.
Thanks, Adil. It was lovely watching you think.
Thank you.
Do you see what we were saying earlier, Scott, how people get consumed in the world? That's why I think it works.
Mm, and it is a safe space, even though they might sound like they're being taken the mick out of, but they're really not. They're pretty neutral tasks, and it's up to them to embarrass themselves, which they do.
It may look on the surface like we're trying to humiliate people, but we're not. Yeah. I think we're sort of celebrating the ridiculousness of all of us.
We have a task for you.
Oh, dear.
What?
That's all right.
That doesn't normally happen.
Could you please say our theme music is by BJ Lederman as many times as you can in 30 seconds?
I have brought the Taskmaster timer, which would you mind if I time myself?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Your time starts now.
Our theme music is by BJ Lederman. Our theme music is by BJ Lederman. Our theme music is by BJ Lederman. Our theme music is by BJ.
Greg Davies and Alex Horn, they are the hosts of Taskmaster.
Our theme music is by BJ Lederman.
You know, 5 seconds would have been plenty.
Our theme music is by BJ Lederman. I got it wrong. Oh, it started well.
Do you want to know how many he did? 22.
I don't care what everyone else says. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you so much, Scott.
It's been so nice being here. Thanks for having us.
It really has.
And our task is to tell you, this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It is just before 9 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. For people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, you can join us at kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, a mix of story and song, hosted by Michael Goldberg. And 10 o'clock, Jen Bowie, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Another cold day ahead, partly to mostly sunny, highs 5 to 10 below zero, with evening lows 18 to 24 below. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 10 below to 1 above, and for Monday, our highs in the single digits above. Support comes from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. And Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 o'clock Monday, January 26 at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are the fourth Monday of the month. Find the board's meeting schedule at kaxe.org. Coming up at noon today, the recorded history of jazz. Right now, it's time for Stay Human.
Hi there, it's time for another hour of story and song. I'm Michael Goldberg with friends and neighbors.